This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian. They'll be joined by guest experts to discuss an array of newsworthy medical and health issues. The physicians and their guests' views are their own and do not represent any institution. Please contact your doctor for any personal questions. Please hit share and join us live on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at She's On Call, hashtag She's On Call. Please welcome our hosts.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar. I'm an ear, nose, and throat surgeon in New York and New Jersey.
And I'm Dr. Marina Kurian. I'm a general surgeon and a weight loss surgeon in New York City.
Welcome to our show, She's On Call.
She's On Call is a show with health professionals who are going to discuss the important topics of the day.
We are live on all the social media channels on Sundays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and you can hear us on Mondays from 2:30 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI. Please like and follow us and tag your friends. It's great to have you here. Marina, it's our 12th show. Can you believe it?
I know. We first started this show together because we thought it would be great opportunity for us to discuss and reach out to people and discuss medical issues. And we started off talking about COVID, but, you know, and at some point we both would like to stop talking about COVID and want to see the tail end of this pandemic. But, you know, so we've been talking a little bit about that as well as other timely news topics and medical topics.
So I think we had two overarching goals when we started this show. Well, maybe three. One, we were bored of the pandemic, so we wanted to do something, and we wanted to do something together, which I think turned out really well. But we wanted to highlight physicians and other healthcare workers that maybe did not look exactly like what people pictured in their minds when they thought about healthcare professionals. And we wanted to cut through a lot of the fake information that was being spread around social media and try to provide facts and thoughtful opinions to you. So one of the things that we talked about is highlighting the accomplishments as we move to more diversity and equality in healthcare. And we got great news this week. My very dear friend, Carol Bradford, who is a top head and neck surgeon, otolaryngologist, was chair of the department at Michigan and vice dean at Michigan, has now taken the role of dean of the medical school at Ohio State College of Medicine at The Ohio State University. There may be 50% of medical school classes that are women, but only a handful reach these upper echelons. Carol is going to start in that position on October 1st, and she's going to be the fourth woman president of the American Academy of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery starting in mid-September. So kudos to Carol.
Well, so, and as you guys may or may not know, Dr. Sajana there was the past president. You're the immediate past president, correct?
I was the third woman, yes.
Third woman. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's really fantastic. So that is great. And there was another thing, like, you know, we wanted to give people sort of real facts, explain it to you in a way that everyone can understand medicine. And I think Sajana and I do that really well in our practice. So we thought this is a great venue. But there's so much misinformation that's out there. So one of the other things that we wanted to talk about was this op-ed that came out talking about hoaxes that are making our jobs harder. And so these are two Twitterati stars, Dr. Seema Yasmeen and Dr. Craig Spencer, talking about all these things that you guys may be seeing either on Facebook or on Twitter that are actually not facts, but are hoaxes. And it's you do spend time saying, no, this doesn't happen. Like that whole thing with the mask. Like if I wear that mask, I'm not going to get oxygen to my brain. We are in the operating room doing high level stuff and need our brains. And you obviously can breathe through it. And the oxygen levels are not affected in the operating room when we wear our masks. So that was like one thing that we saw a lot of. There's another one, Suju, that you saw.
Yeah, so this week I actually got asked on WhatsApp and Facebook and a number of areas about this video that's going by that has beautiful production value that says basically the forehead temperature measuring device, which kind of looks like a water pistol. You kind of point it at the person's forehead, was somehow causing brain damage and specifically damage to the pineal gland, which is very deep in the brain. It's in the midbrain, quite deep in, and controls melatonin and controls some hormonal secretions. But that is hogwash. The video is beautiful. It's very well made, very nice quality of hogwash. So no, taking your temperature with a gun or an infrared ray or whatever will not give you brain damage. So please don't listen to things that sound crazy.
What I love about that gun, though, and I was just saying that this morning because my friends, I'm at a friend's house and they have it. They were checking temperature. They checked mine. And I was like, you know, it's so weird. Like I used to, in my office, I had the ones that you put in your mouth with the new covers, right? Mm-hmm. We switched to the forehead. There was the ear one. We switched to the forehead scan, which is just really a wipe across the forehead. Where was this gun before the pandemic?
Like, right.
I'm so glad they made it. Are you kidding? This is so fantastic. Now it really is no touch. You don't have to. The other one with the forehead scan, you wiped it down. It obviously would break down after a while because you keep wiping it with alcohol wipes. So this is actually a fantastic intervention and it does not cause brain damage.
No. Valerie Fitzhugh Cull says, looking forward to another great show. So are we. We have some amazing guests on. If you have hearing issues, we are closed captioned for sure on our YouTube channel. Please hit like and share and tell your friends, tag your friends if you think they're interested in hearing about these important medical topics we're going to discuss.
Joining us is Dr. Marcia Harris, who is a colorectal surgeon in private practice in NYC. And our other guest is Dr. Monica Gutierrez, who is, I think, chief of the Division of Rehab Medicine at UT San Antonio. And she's joining us, and we're going to be talking to her as well. And so this is very exciting because I think that this is a timely show because there's a couple of different topics that we want to talk to them about.
So I think, you know, everybody, unfortunately, has been talking about colon cancer this weekend with the passing of Chadwick Boseman from colon cancer at a very young age. People are also talking about these long haulers, these people who have prolonged symptoms even after they've recovered from COVID-19. So thank you, Marcia and Monica, for coming on board. We're going to talk a little bit about both of those subjects. So welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're kidding? It's so fantastic. It's really great. We get a lot of view time and then we get some reviews too. So what you say will definitely be looked at several times, which is, I think, very important. Let's talk about Chadwick Boseman a little bit. And, you know, people are like, wait, I didn't realize he was in all these films. So this gentleman had colon cancer, was undergoing treatment while he was doing all of these films. And that, you know, shows you his talent, his commitment, and to think that, you know, he did all of this while undergoing treatment is a big deal. So did Monica, you know, you must have had a lot of blow up, but all of us have seen a lot of stuff on Twitter, Facebook, et cetera. It's a sad and a terrible loss for really the artistic community, for his family, obviously, but for all of us who are fans. And so do you, anyway, there's this cute accolades and homage to him, especially from when he was in the Avengers movie, right? It was Endgame. And there's a picture of him surrounded, you know, he's fallen, but he's surrounded by all the people, all the Marvel heroes.
Yeah, there are so many children who kind of did the Wakanda Forever cross with him surrounded by the other superheroes. And I, in some ways, not only did he play a superhero, but he played real people. He played Jackie Robinson, Thurgood Marshall. He played amazing characters, but he was sort of a superhero to all of us, including James. He played James Brown. 43 is ridiculously young to die of stage 4 colon cancer. I'm amazed that he was able to work on all these movies while struggling through stage 3 and then stage 4. And I'm wondering, Marcia, if you can talk to our listeners and us about what to look for. I think if you remember when Katie Couric's husband got colon cancer, there was a big time for public service announcements about what to do, how to prevent this, how to detect it early. And I think this is one such moment.
Absolutely. Colon cancer is the third most common cancer that we have in the country. Ultimately, the majority of cancers are without any symptoms, so they're completely asymptomatic. When they do get it to a little bit more advanced stage, you may have some abdominal pain, some bleeding, difficulty passing your stools, change in the stool caliber. So rather than being a big, healthy stool, it starts to be a narrower stool. Towards the latter stages, when we start to think about the spread of the disease, you're looking more at weight loss and constitutional symptoms like fatigue and not really being up to any kind of task. You can see later signs of jaundice, particularly with extreme metastasis or tumor burden of the liver. So the presentation of the disease, majority of the times when we catch it early enough, is usually asymptomatic. And that makes screening much more important.
So, you know, if they're asymptomatic, and it is unfortunately still the second leading cause of cancer deaths, and although the average age is older, we do see it, unfortunately, in younger people who may be disregarding some early signs and symptoms or don't meet the screening criteria. So can you talk to us about different ways to screen for colon cancer, even in asymptomatic individuals?
Absolutely. You touched on an important point, because our younger population usually sees blood in the bowl or have difficulty moving their stools, and they will commonly attribute it to hemorrhoids. So bringing those patients in and talking to them and getting their full story and addressing their symptoms are important. For those patients who don't have any symptoms, the primary care physicians become a particular ally to us because they're able to send these people for screening methods. We have simple things like fecal occult blood testing, where they give us some stool samples and we test for microscopic blood. Other simple things would be that kind of testing coupled with the sigmoidoscopy, because the stool occult, fecal occult blood test only tests for right-sided bleeding and not so much left-sided bleeding. So adding sigmoidoscopy to the mix helps us identify left-sided colon cancers. And ideally, what we like to do is screening colonoscopies, where you prepare your colon by getting the colon clean the day before by drinking laxatives, and we bring you in and sedate you and look throughout your colon with a camera through the scope. The other thing that we have available now is Cologuard, which patients do at home. And it's not replacing this form of screening, but what it does is advocate for patients who are really resistant to getting colonoscopies, that if they get a positive test on the Cologuard, it really, you know, we really encourage them to come in and let us do these colonoscopies so we could further evaluate them.
You know, I love how you put that in about, hey, you know, you take some laxatives and just do a prep before the colonoscopy. Having turned that age, which we should talk about too, in terms of screening, what age should we start? And obviously family history matters. A prep is no joke. That is, I was originally planning on going to a concert that night. I'm like, I'll just do the prep and then go to the concert. And my husband's like, he had already gone through it. He's like, oh, you're not leaving the house. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'll be fine. No, he was right. I had to stick so close to the bathroom. I stayed in the bathroom for 3 hours. My son was like, are you okay? What's happening? I'm like, prep. I have a prep. I'm doing a prep. It was, you know, it's funny now in retrospect, but it is not a joke.
Absolutely. Well, we have better preps now since probably you've gotten yours. We have lower volume preps, which patients tend to tolerate much better, rather than the four liter jug that the older population might have seen in the past. We have things like movie prep and clean pick and plan view, which cut down the volume, but does rely on you drinking a fair amount on your own. The prep is a prep. There's really no way around it. You got to poop. You got to get it clean. So, you know, you got to go through that part of it. But if that's the worst part of us catching cancer early, I'll stay in the bathroom a long time.
Yeah, I love that, Marcia.
Well said, well said.
So next we have Dr. Gutierrez. Monica, welcome. You know, we were debating, we were like, do we say PM&R, which is physical medicine and rehabilitation? Do we say rehab physician or rehab medicine, or do we say physiatry? And it turns out they're all correct, right? And you guys do such a breadth of stuff that we're like, it's not just, you know, like work for, you know, after a stroke, it's cardiac rehab, it's orthopedic rehab, it's so many different things that you guys cover, really.
Right. It was like, it doesn't matter. Just call me. As I said, call me what you want to call me. Physiatrist, physical medicine and rehab medicine. And it's a specialty that focuses on function and quality of life and enhancing people's quality of life, whether it be after something as minor as an injury versus something as major as spinal cord injury or a brain injury or a stroke, to everything that's in between, including pain symptoms, including even dealing with patients who have cancer and who need cancer rehabilitation. So we are specialists that will take care of persons along all the continuum of care. They even find for patients with cancer that doing prehabilitation, so getting them ready to have the best outcomes from their surgery and from their adjuvant chemotherapy, will do better. And then along with COVID, which is a big topic right now, then physiatrists also can help people prehab while they're just hanging out at home, versus also as their symptoms are occurring, we can see patients as soon as they're in the ICU. We can see them when they've started to recover and they may need more intensive rehabilitation, and also in the outpatient setting. So it's a specialty I hadn't heard of before I went to medical school, but I'm really glad that I did.
I like the rehab and prehab. And I think as surgeons, we actually pay a lot of attention to that prehab, because we know that our outcomes are better when our patients are as well as they can be before surgery. So I like that concept a lot.
It was a new concept though, because before we'd be like, well, we need to medically optimize the patient. You got to go see your doctor, maybe get a cardiology evaluation. But now, and especially with major surgeries, and for like, you know, when we do a lot of abdominal wall reconstruction, prehab has become such a big deal. And it's kind of a new concept, isn't it? Or did the cardiac guys get this way before and not share that information? Or are you guys all like, no, we all did it, you just did it?
Yeah, it was like we've kind of been working on it for a little while, but it's fairly new, and where there's actually studies behind it that says, hey, let's do prehab, and this exercise, aerobic exercise you're doing, is going to do, you know, neovascularization to help chemo to get where you need it to get in pancreatic cancer patients. And so it's something that definitely has been around, but now there's a bigger focus on it for sure.
So I'll tell you, in my world, when we're going to do skull-based tumor surgery or acoustic tumor surgery, and the patient is expected to be quite dizzy and vertiginous post-op, we actually rely on prehab to maximize their vestibular status before surgery so that their recovery is faster. And you're right, Marina, nobody held it back from us. I think this is a relatively new concept that has really taken off, and our outcomes are so much better. The length of stay in the hospital is less. The ability to return to activities of daily living is so much better. And this is very different than just doing some hand exercises or something. This is really a whole medical approach. I wanted to point out that we have people watching from all over. We have Helm Apollo Ali watching from Las Vegas. We have somebody whose name I didn't quite catch watching from Kashmir. We have usually Ermine Hero watching from Finland. We have Mark Lee watching from North Carolina. We have people watching from all over. One of the questions to you, Marcia, and please, can I encourage our viewers to like and tag and tell your friends? We had somebody tag a bunch of their friends who these are extraordinary guests that Marina and I get the pleasure of talking to every week, and I hope we can share that with other people. One of the questions we had was about general anesthesia versus propofol versus something else for colonoscopy. And maybe we can segue from that, Marcia, into the stages of cancer. So we heard about Mr. Bozeman having stage 3 cancer while he was making those movies and then eventually dying of stage 4 cancer. We've heard differently about Duke's classification of cancer. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what all those words mean.
Sure. Let's go a little bit back to the previous question about the sedation or the anesthesia used for the colonoscopies. The majority of colonoscopies are done under just sedation with propofol anesthetic. And this is an anesthetic that we give to sedate the patient so they're comfortably sleeping and breathing on their own. And once the procedure is over, when we shut it off, it's usually a pretty quick wake-up process. General anesthesia is usually reserved for patients who are high risk. In any way, maybe they have a pulmonary issue or cardiac issue that make them high risk, and you cannot do them under sedation. And those types of colonoscopies are naturally done in the hospital. Okay. In regards to the stages of colon cancer, I'm just going to keep it very basic. We use a T&M staging. We got rid of the Duke's classification. T meaning the amount of tumor invasion you get, N being the nodal, the lymph node involvement, and M being metastasis, which means a spread from where the tumor originated to a distant organ. So stage 1 is pretty much a tumor that will involve the superficial layers of the colon. And this is pretty easily treated with just surgical resection with a 5-year survival of 90%. Stage 2 cancers are cancers that go a little deeper into the colon, like into the muscle, towards what we call the serosa, which is the outer lining of the colon. And this also is treated very well with a surgical resection, with the exception of some patients who have high risk factors, such as, you know, poor tumor biology, whether or not it has gone beyond the wall or perforated through the wall, or the nature of the biology may involve mucinous cells or cygnet cells, which portend a poor prognosis. Stage 3 cancers are cancers that involve the lymph nodes. And these type of cancers will require adjuvant chemotherapy, which means chemotherapy after the removal of the cancer. And then stage 4, like we talked about before, is when the cancer has spread beyond the primary tumor into distant locations, normally the liver, followed by the peritoneal surface, which is the inner lining of the abdomen, to the lung. Brain is not normally seen, but can be seen usually in rectal cancers.
Yeah, that's a lot. And I have friends who've gone through this. And in terms of this ongoing, you know, you catch the local disease, but then they have a spread. And it is so worrisome, mainly because I think for most people, once you know you have lymph node involvement, right? So you have the tumor and then it's in the colon and then it moves to the lymph nodes. And then once you have that, even though you might have excised the area and you have no evidence of disease, some of those patients still get the metastasis at a later time. And so it's that constant worry that can be really hard. How do you deal with that, Marcia, with your patients?
Well, I mean, I think the difference now is that we have some better chemotherapy choices than we did in the past. With the addition of oxaliplatinum chemotherapy, we've seen that what used to be a 40 to 50% survival for someone with advanced stage 3 colon cancer, we're now seeing up on the orders of upper 60 to 70% of patients having a 5-year survival. So with these improvement in our chemotherapies, we're seeing better survival. However, recurrence is an issue because obviously if there's 70% of people who have a 5-year survival, there's 30% who don't. So recurrences are a challenge, and that's where monitoring is very important. I normally do it in conjunction with my medical oncologist that I use. Initially, you know, after the immediate postoperative period, when the patient's doing well and they start chemotherapy, everything goes well. Following completion of that, we see them every 3 months and we send blood work, particularly the CEA. Now, CEA is a marker that we use. It's a nonspecific marker that we use, and we get it before the surgery, and we use it after the surgery to monitor recurrence. So when we start to see increases in the CEA, that's a sign that there's probably a sign of recurrence coming on or present. And in that case, PET scan, which is positron emission tomography scanning, using a CT scan in addition, will help us locate any of these areas of recurrence. Now, if it's a local recurrence, we have surgical resection still available where we can go in and re-resect that area or remove whatever it is. However, if there's distant spread to the liver or the lung, then it becomes more complicated and more controversial. Certainly, chemotherapy is on the table. And then if there's only a solitary metastasis, like a single hepatic metastasis, we can excise that, and the same with the lung. Obviously, though, once you start to get distant spread, your five-year survival is going to decrease.
So I think that's really important. I think you've raised these huge concepts that are really important for patients to understand. So I think you talked about the asymptomatic individual, or somebody who's young and healthy, feels great, and should start screening at least at 45, and certainly younger if they experience any of the other symptoms you talked about. I think you talked about the different outcomes when we catch the tumors early versus when they are quite late by the time we catch them. And I think you talked about the ongoing care that both the surgeon, the gastroenterologist, and the oncologist can give the patient, and screening measures that we have. And this is really, this speaks to the continuum of care that we try to provide all patients, whether their problem is cancer or otherwise.
This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian.
We are live on all the social media channels on Sundays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and you can hear us on Mondays from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI. Please like and follow us and tag your friends. Sort of switching gears back to COVID-19 at the moment. You know, we are seeing worldwide increases in cases. We've had over 180,000 deaths in the United States from this. The U.S. is still, unfortunately, at the top of the leaderboard for cases. And we are actually at the top of the leaderboard, not only for all cases, but for active cases and ongoing cases. And in the beginning, we thought it was one and done. So either you got better or you had a terrible course and perished. And now we're seeing something that we're calling long haulers. And these are the people with ongoing symptoms that we didn't really expect from the beginning. And this is somewhere where we've seen a lot of data come out that's early. Marina and I always talk about the fact that we didn't know about this disease before January of this year. But Monica, Dr. Gutierrez, maybe you can talk to us about who these long haulers are, what kind of symptoms they have, and what can we do to ensure that they have as good a quality of life as they go forward.
And you know what, I just want to interject one thing. There are at least two recent articles about this concept of long haulers, which is why we wanted to discuss it. And we were so thrilled because we saw, you know, Monica, your tweet on the topic, because it was, people were supposed to be getting better and they weren't. And now, you know, now we are realizing that there's a, I guess, not chronic. I don't know. I don't think we know, right? It's been 9 months. This is right. Like a horrible viral pregnancy. It's horrible. Like, we just don't know all the answers right now.
Yeah, we don't. And I think what we're just seeing what's come out of it. And one of the first papers that came out was one that came out of Italy that said, here are these patients that had COVID. For the most part, the ones in the study were not hospitalized, and that they looked at their symptoms 2 months later, and that 87% of people were still having ongoing symptoms 2 months after they had COVID. So these were moderate type COVID symptoms and still having then ongoing symptoms 2 months later, fatigue, shortness of breath, inability to do exercise, aches and pains, headaches. So again, as I tell everyone, it's something that this is not anything that we've dealt with before, but I saw it as a way that this is not the first time that we've had a pandemic. And this is also not the first time that PM&R has come out to help patients with multiple issues. Actually, PM&R, the history of it is that some of it came out of both people surviving World War II and needing to serve those patients. And the other thing was the polio pandemic. also around the 1930s, 40s, 50s that went a long time, and we had to take care of people who were in iron lungs and who were very sick and who had disabilities. And so I said, this is our opportunity now as physiatrists to take on a new pandemic and take care of people as early as in the ICU, where we know about PICS or post-intensive care syndrome, and we care for people with symptoms in the ICU, to now where we have patients with these long hauler symptoms. So months after they've had COVID, they continue to have symptomatology. That study that you showed from the University of Indiana shows us, you know, the top five symptoms that people are having. Again, the fatigue, overwhelming amount of post-viral fatigue, which has been shown that other viruses can cause, muscles and body aches, shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, difficulty with concentration, people just saying, I can't find my words any as like I used to, my memory's not as good as it was, and then hard to exercise, especially these are people that said, oh, I used to be able to go and walk miles or jog miles, and now I can't even walk around the block, and then headache, pain symptoms. And yes, if you go down and look at the list, anxiety, dizziness, and a lot of the anxiety is then coupled with the worry about what's going to happen to them, or what, you know, you hear these horror stories or you read about things of sudden death or people doing better and then getting a lot worse. And so that made a lot of anxiety, plus the social distancing. They're not able to be around people or their friends, and they're not home and getting very anxious about their disease state. And so these are things that we're seeing. There's different clinics that have been set up, and I say some of it I'm used to working with, because my day job is I usually take care of patients who have strokes or traumatic brain injury, concussions, and some of these symptoms are similar. They may have dizziness, they may have headaches, they may have a difficult time exercising or concentrating. So, and again, physiatrists take care of patients of all. We are trained in lots of disease states. We know about patients who need cardiac rehab or who may need pulmonary rehab or who have been in the ICU. So for that reason, I think that we're exceptionally well ready to take care of patients with the effects of COVID-19.
Have you found, Monica, that these patients are seeing some improvement with therapy now that we are identifying that they need some additional help? And I think obviously that we're figuring this out, and we as the royal we, it's you guys that are taking care of them. So, because it's all about hope, right? Once you have this disease and you didn't die from it, so that was great. But now you have these residual symptoms, as you just pointed out. Sometimes it's also brain fog, where you're just not functioning up to your normal capacity. And you want to know that you are ultimately going to get better. This is not going to be like, there's some comparison to have it fall under, which I didn't know this acronym, but it's MECFS, right? Which is myalgic encephalomyelitis / chronic fatigue syndrome, which back in the 90s, I thought I had it. Was that in the 90s? No, 80s, late 80s. I thought I had it. We called it the yuppie disease, you know, chronic fatigue. And, it could have been based on chronic Epstein-Barr virus or something like that. But now this is showing you that these patients might fall into another category that will have to encompass a long hauler. What are your thoughts on that?
So for the CFS, I think, you know, before, you're right, they thought, oh, this is a yuppie disease. It's just, you know, it's in your head, just get over it, just do more exercise. And that's not the answer. And that there may be some connection with an immune phenomenon or with having the cytokine storm or having inflammation in the system. And that we know that it's not just, oh, go see your therapist and get over it and, you know, go exercise some more. We really have to be careful how we treat those patients and how we get them back to function is, you know, you can't just push them, because then they're going to go two steps back. It has to be very symptom limited therapy and start slowly and step by step, and then also continue to do the research on what's the underlying causes, what's making it worse. Do we have to work on the inflammatory part of it? So it's something that, you know, I believe that it can definitely be connected and that we need to start looking at some more. And that rehab, to answer your question even at the beginning, was that rehab, the correct directed rehab is going to help people with these different, with different symptoms. The other thing to bring up is there are some papers also and research that's showing the cardiac effects of COVID, with there being effects of including myocarditis. And so we have to make sure that we're also screening patients as they get back to activity as well. And they are, you know, College of Sports Medicine, cardiology has come out with papers that say these are how you need to screen athletes who are young, who are getting back to sports, especially, you know, they're doing this at the college level, football, et cetera. But, you know, we need to do that in adults too, and in patients who are surviving COVID, and to ensure that, you know, they're not going to, because if you do have a myocarditis, you actually are not supposed to be pushing exercise because there's an increased risk of sudden cardiac death, or are you going to get heart failure related to myocarditis and that need to be treated?
So, I think, you know, one of the slides we put up earlier showed the some red bars and the blue symptoms. And what it's showing us is that the symptoms that are defined by the CDC are in the red bars, but the symptoms that we're actually seeing as healthcare professionals are all those blue bars. So there is a disconnect as we learn. And then maybe to have the final question on this, one of our viewers asked if this is a, if this chronic condition or this long haul is a resurgence or reinfection of disease. Helm Apollo Ali asked us that. And then maybe we can talk about myocarditis is inflammation of the cardiac muscle. Is that painful? There's a list of painful and not so painful long haul symptoms that was in that same paper. Maybe you can talk to us about that.
So a couple things. So the symptoms that were highlighted versus what the CDC says, and I think the CDC can show some of the symptoms that you're going to have initially, but then what people end up having long term is definitely different. As far as, you know, is it a resurgence or what happens when they continue to have symptoms or reinfection? I don't think we know, but is it still related to the cytokine storm and the change of our inflammatory markers in our body during, you know, this post-viral syndrome? Possibly so. And then the myocarditis, is it one of the painful symptoms per se? It does not have to be. It's not, sometimes it's, you don't even know that you have it, but the painful symptoms is anything from people having terrible headaches, body aches, joint pains, nerve problems. Yes, if you have chest pain or pressure, then that is definitely painful. And that's definitely something that would need a more further look in a cardiac workup type of way. But we're seeing nerve issues, neuropathy, including the patients that we're getting in the hospital. We're doing some EMG tests on them, and we are seeing nerve and muscle issues. And so definitely a lot of painful symptoms that can either help us focus on a secondary workup or know, okay, let's start treating these symptoms that you're having.
This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian.
We are live on all the social media channels on Sundays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and you can hear us on Mondays from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI. Please like and follow us and tag your friends. We have a question from... We really appreciate all the questions from our viewers and them checking in from all over the place. Thank you so much. Obviously, our guests are incredibly engaging and the topics are so valuable. We have a question for Monica, for Dr. Gutierrez from Falguni Vaidya. She wants to know if we have some patients who had COVID who had very temporary taste and smell disturbance, and we have many patients who had COVID who have recovered except for the taste and smell disturbance. Is that a neurological issue? What can be done to hasten that recovery?
Okay, great question. So yes, that's something that we are seeing, and some people get their taste and smell back 100% in a few days. Some only kind of get it somewhat. And then we still have patients who haven't gotten it back yet. And then they have done things. There are MRI studies that they've done in COVID patients and non-COVID patients and looked at MRIs and saw that olfactory areas are affected in the brain as well as the hippocampus. And so what am I, for patients that have ongoing as anosmia, and which is loss of smell, then that is tied into your taste. So what can be done for that? Some of the things that we know that can be helped. These are not new conditions. This has happened with other viruses. You're an ENT, you probably know that. In traumatic brain injury, it's actually the cranial nerve that's most affected just because of where it is along the cribriform plate. And so what we tell people, nasal steroids is one thing that can be done. And also, in some patients, gabapentin may help some. The other thing that we do is smell training. And I know that seems a little funny, but it is actually true. And you can go online and read a little bit about it. But it really has something to do with, you know, getting certain smells, getting, you know, scented, and just work on smelling them a couple times a day and focusing on it in a mindful way while you're trying to smell it. And that helps smell come back. Also, it really also means when you're eating, you may have to spice it up a little bit more in the short term to get some of the taste back or to taste it a little bit more. So there are some things to do to work on it.
That's amazing. Well, I had no idea that you could do all that.
Yeah. And one of the points we actually make to our patients is they will not be able to smell a gas leak or fire. So it's really, really important that they have the batteries changed on their smoke detector and their carbon monoxide detectors. It's really important. Anupama Bindingnavale, who is watching us from Bangalore, India, asked about hallucinations. And I think she meant olfactory hallucinations after COVID. And have you seen this at all?
So it is. It's kind of a spectrum of what can happen to your smell. To either you have none, you can get cacosmia, which is, you know, smelling something that's a terrible smell, having less of a smell, having no smell. So these are all kind of a spectrum of what happens when you lose your sense of smell. And like I said, on the MRIs showing the olfactory centers affected in the brain, that means the areas where your brain also takes in smell, you know, takes in smell and figures out what smell is. And so, yes, that can be seen for sure.
But can you mitigate that at all?
Oh, it's one of those things, again, try smell training, try to see what happens with time.
Monica and Marcia, actually. Marcia, I have a question. You know, we started off the hour talking about Chadwick Boseman and his death at age 43, when we said that it usually, and you said actually, that occurs in later or older age groups. But is it true or is it not true that when you get it at a younger age, it can be more aggressive disease? Can it also be more, when you get it at a younger age, it can be a genetic syndrome or familial type of cancer?
And I'm going to say, and there is in fact a racial disparity issue with colon cancer. So now we're just going to give you a really tough question to answer all at once, Marcia.
Absolutely. I'll start with your side of it. There is a higher rate of colorectal cancer that occurs in the younger age in African Americans. And before we actually changed the screening protocol to 45, for everyone, there was some talk of whether or not we should be screening African Americans a lot sooner than the rest of the population. Indeed, you can have sporadic cancers that occur in a younger age, which means they don't have any hereditary base involved. It just happens because of mutations in certain genes along the way. Other things are related to hereditary cancers, such as Lynch syndrome, some cancers related to the BRCA gene, BRCA2 to be specific. So there are inherited colorectal cancers that can occur. But who knows, in his case, you'd have to really do a family history to look at not only colon cancers, but other cancers. Is there prostate cancer in the family? Is there ovarian cancer in the family? Is there breast cancers in the family? Because there are other genetic disorders such as the P53 gene, which controls a lot of tumors that when you have a mutation in the tumor suppressor gene of p53, you can develop any sort of cancer along the way. So we won't really know in Chadwick's case. And when we see early cancers like this, we do send them for genetic testing so we can sort that out. Because for them, you know, their situation is their situation. But if there are other members of their family, it's important that we get those people into the mix to make sure they don't share the same fate.
Dr. Harris, I really appreciate what you do. And just a little bit of my story. Oh, my father had colon cancer when he was young. He was in his late 40s and had a recurrence as well. And he's alive and he's doing well. But it is something that, you know, we had to look. Okay, he was young. Did he have any of those genetic syndromes? Maybe not at the time that they found. This has been over 20 years at this point. And so I'm really thankful for those that study this, look at this, take care of these patients. It also made me get my colonoscopy before the official screening age, because if a family member had it when they were younger than 50, you're supposed to get it 10 years before they had theirs. So I had mine probably even a couple years later than I was supposed to, but still before the age of 45. And thanks.
Yeah. So Anupama wrote back and said, first of all, I'm so happy your dad is doing well. And really, that is the story of many patients who get their cancers identified early, as Dr. Harris has pointed out. Anupama was talking about the hallucinations of sharp temperature elevations during COVID-19. So I think those are attributed to that sort of fever, hallucinatory state, the acute dehydration. Anything we can offer patients and their families who are a little freaked out by the hallucinations?
It's peace of mind, just knowing that, yes, I think a lot of people want to know that it's normal. It can happen. You can, you know, fevers can cause this, and just the inflammation that's going on the system, and that for most people this is going to pass. It's just that acute time that people are getting the hallucinations.
So I have two more questions from viewers. Danny Chelius, who's an otolaryngologist, remembered a
med school together.
I know, we're all like this cabal, right? He remembers this funny commercial about if you don't take Metamucil, you're going to get cancer. But all kidding aside, let's talk a little bit about if you don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, what can you do in terms of that kind of fiber? And then Benj Cantors, who is watching either from Chicago or from some idyllic place north of Chicago, asks about, isn't it always taking care about your microbiome?
Well, colon cancer is actually, the reasons for colon cancer are multifactorial. So it's never just one thing. It's always helpful to maintain a healthy microbiome. So yes, it is important. I don't want to minimize that, but it's more than just one thing. And in regards to people who don't have access to healthy fruits and vegetables, there are other things you can do. You can use grains, such as like oatmeal and that sort of thing. Other things, like when I have my young patients who I know are not eating a healthy diet, they're in college or eating whatever they can get their hands on, I just usually tell them to take a supplemental fiber, whether it be psyllium, which is Metamucil, or Citricel, or Benefiber I like, because it dissolves, it doesn't taste like anything. I'm more likely to get them to take it if it doesn't taste bad and it's not coarse. So that's one option if a patient really doesn't have access to healthy, you know, fruits and vegetables.
You know, Marcia, it's hard. You said when you have the younger people, which is funny. I like to tell my patients if they need fiber, I'm like, oh, take the orange Metamucil. It's like Tang. And like, what's Tang? Nobody knows what Tang is. But these kids today, they don't know what Tang is. All right, you guys, we're actually running out of time, sadly, because we could talk with you all day, except that you guys all have stuff to do. So let's start with Monica. If you want to give us your final three thoughts, you want to share with our viewers and the world at large, you can.
Right. Okay, my final three thoughts about this, just since, you know, I came to talk about COVID, is that we're not over the hump, that COVID is still a thing. So it's not time to let our guard down, especially if you've not had it yet, that we still have to do all the right things about social distancing and wearing a mask. The other thing is that if you're suffering, know that you're not suffering alone and that you should go find help. And the other part of it is, again, a community. There are communities for people who are suffering from the long hauler symptoms, whether that be a social media community, just it, or finding your family or your friends to help support you. And I think that we need a lot of community during this time.
Excellent. And, you know, one other thing, Marcia, before you do your top three, one of the topics that we didn't bring up during our Sujana Marina chat time was the fact that the CDC kind of walked back their recommendation to test asymptomatic people. And if we were going to just do a poll amongst ourselves, do we check people for COVID even if they don't have symptoms? I vote yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, testing, tracing, isolation. I think there were a couple of funny governmental edicts this week regarding the lack of cutting down on testing and promoting just convalescent plasma where it can work for some people, but not for everyone. So I think, again, we're learning a lot and we're doing our best to find the facts and present them to you. So, I think we have to
piggyback on
watching our distance, you know, washing our hands, getting our tests, figure out who we were around. So Marcia, I'm gonna lead it off to you now.
Sure, just to piggyback on the last thing you just said, as a protocol at our hospital, they make us test everyone who's coming in for surgery. And you'd be surprised how many people test positive that's asymptomatic. So, you know, can you imagine bringing these people into an environment where the other patients believe that they're safe? So if we didn't do that, what would happen to the other people in our health community, the nurses, the doctors, the other providers? So I think it's very important to test patients who are asymptomatic. Now, my last three points are, first of all, like you mentioned earlier, the screening age has now changed from 50 to 45. So it's important to get that message out. So no, you don't have five more years. 45 is the age of screening. And to be very vocal about that so patients know they should come in for that and to not be afraid to come in and have the test done. Number two, if you have symptoms, don't just attribute them to hemorrhoids or something else and poo-poo them. Because like Chadwick Boseman, even though we don't know what his health history was, you can be young and healthy and this cancer can affect you. And lastly, just having colon cancer is not a death sentence. That's why we push so hard for screening practices, because if we catch it early, you can live a very long life. You know, as Monica attested to, her father had it early, got a recurrence, and he's still doing well 20 years down the line. So early detection is very important.
Well, I want to thank you guys so much for joining us today. It's been such a pleasure. So thank you so much, Dr. Marcia Harris. Again, she's a colorectal surgeon in private practice in New York City. And Dr. Monica Gutierrez, she's the chief of PM&R, right, at UT San Antonio. Also a full professor. I love that. You know, we were talking earlier about how many deans. There are not a lot of full professors that are women in our major medical center. So I think it's wonderful that you're there. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you both so much for joining us. We want to thank our producers because this show does not produce itself. And we're very lucky to have incredible people behind us, kind of keeping everything running smoothly and collating all of your questions and comments. So thank you guys so much. Next week is Labor Day weekend in America, and we are going to take the day off, but we will have a best of episode, which I have to tell you, I love the best of episodes. We have such amazing guests, and our producers pick some snippets and share them with us. And so if you can, please watch either live or later, 11 a.m. Eastern time next Sunday as well. And we have a great new thing that's happening, Marina.
We're excited.
Yeah.
We're going to be on WBAI radio at 2:30 to 3 o'clock Eastern time on Mondays. They're going to replay part of our shows. And I think if you guys you know, can tune into that. It's 99.5 FM in New York, but worldwide, it's on WBAI.org.
And finally, in honor of Chadwick Boseman, who lived an incredibly full and rich life and enriched our lives, we want to sign off. Wakanda forever.
Oh, Wakanda forever. Totally. Look at that.
And thank you, Dr. Twin Capers. Wakanda forever.
Yeah, that's beautiful.